You'll each have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. There's a timer on the center podium, and it will reset according to the time for your argument. There's also an adjustment button there, so you can set it to your height. And I would just ask each of you to introduce yourselves at the beginning of your argument for the sake of our recording, and also so that we know how to pronounce your name and your client's names. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin when you are ready.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Dan Kohler, and I represent the appellant, Sean Allen Shaney, in this appeal. And like any other criminal sexual conduct case, arguing this case is uncomfortable. I'm treading that fine line between minimizing the conduct that was agreed upon and also making sure that it's not, that we're not unduly exaggerating what happened, specifically in terms of the guidelines. And that's why Mr. Shaney filed this appeal. He exercised his right to review knowing that the district court had nearly unbridled discretion to determine whether or not it was appropriate to sentence according to an upward departure. He knows this court, even if it was inclined to do the to do something different, your hands are tied based on the standard of review. But it's not unbridled discretion at the district court level, and there are standards to make sure that the sentencing guidelines are not being minimized. And in this case, we're asking this court to determine, just as the district court did this actually qualify as an exception to a guideline sentence? Is this an example of the extraordinary type of case that warrants an upward departure? You know, does this record support somebody being treated differently than the vast majority of people who commit the same heinous crime? Because especially when the victim is young and it involves sexual assault, the tendency is to push things as far as they can. The state certainly tried in this case. Charges were dismissed. The state was trying to charge under different statutes, alleging significant relationship with the victim, alleging additional contacts. None of that's in the record for the purposes of the upward departure. All we have is that the court found that she was particularly vulnerable, and as the basis for that, we've got she was in foster care, and there were extensive contacts between Mr. Shaney and the victim here.
Mr. Kohler, didn't the district court also found, and I'll just repeat the vernacular that was used by the district court, that she was a messed up kid? And when I read your client's plea colloquy, it does seem that there is some factual basis to support some findings that this is a little bit different, or maybe a lot different, than a typical minor who is involved in this kind of activity. Given the nature of her foster situation, that she was in a locked facility, that she had run away, that it was cold out, and he was essentially there for her.
No, and I've struggled with that. When I first read that, not even being cheeky, I said this to my law partner. I'm like, in my life, I have never met a 14-year-old girl that's not messed up and not tongue-in-cheek. Like, at that age, every 14-year-old girl is particularly vulnerable.
But this is a little bit different. I mean, you know, there's a vulnerability because of being a teenage girl, and there's vulnerability for being a teenage girl in foster care, in a locked facility, having done something to get them in a locked facility. I don't know what that is, but it does indicate that there was some discussion about that, that your client knew about it, and that she had run away from the facility and was needing a place to be.
And one of my goals in this argument is to make sure we're distinguishing those types of facts, because not a typical 14-year-old is not in foster care, but to distinguish that from all of the particular vulnerabilities that are going to exist in any case of this nature.
So then my question really, let's bring it back to the legal standard, is why aren't these facts that are elicited during the plea colloquy enough to substantiate the district court's finding of particular vulnerability.
And in this case, a lot of it boils down, in my opinion, to the fact that, as was discussed in the previous appeal, what's the baseline? Because the typical case is one thing, but the state's burden was to convince the court that there were substantial and compelling reasons beyond that. Like, so with the text contact, I honestly don't know how often 14-year-old girls text, if this was particularly egregious or if this was common. I know a lot of the negative facts, that there was no force used, that there were no threats used, you know, that he was deemed amenable to treatment. Probation decided that he was amenable to probationary supervision and not an execution of sentence. He wasn't in a position of power or authority or in a substantial relationship with the victim in this case. There was a trust relationship there, but the legislature has gone to great lengths to define numerous different situations and circumstances whereby somebody is not only particularly vulnerable, but it's actually a separate crime. And none of that applied here. So, Mr. Shaney.
But, counsel, you'd agree that the, you know, the list of aggravating factors in the sentencing guidelines is non-exclusive. So, the guidelines do include a victim who's particularly vulnerable due to age, infirmity, or reduced physical or mental capacity, and age is already accounted for in the statute, and I don't think we have any of those other descriptive adjectives here, but couldn't the victim still be particularly vulnerable for other reasons? Couldn't that justify a departure on that basis?
I would agree that the list is non-exhaustive, and just because none of the enumerated issues apply, that doesn't restrict the court from finding particularly vulnerability. I do think it gives a reviewing court heightened review for an abuse of discretion. Not that I'm asking the court to change the standard, but the case law does point out the simple fact that our appellate courts have a broader experience in this context than a district court judge. You've seen hundreds of sentencing appeals. It puts you in a position where you can better assess whether the conduct arose to the level where it should have been an upward departure under the guidelines. You've seen a wide variety of departures. You've seen a wide variety of guideline sentences. And so there is that, I forget the phrase, collegiate authority, or it was very feel good. But I'm hoping to rely a little bit on that in this argument because it's not an enumerated issue. And I don't think it would be appropriate to say every time the victim was in foster care, you know, it's the equivalent of being too young or being mentally incapacitated or being drugged. And here, Mr. Shaney was also in foster care growing up, which seems to underlie some of the arguments that she was not only particularly vulnerable, but that he knew it. But I don't think just having a shared experience is enough to rise to the level of particular vulnerability.
Doesn't this go beyond a shared experience in terms of he had to have knowledge of the particular vulnerability, and it sounds like you agree he had that knowledge about her foster care situation, that she was a multiple-time runaway, et cetera, that things weren't going well in her foster home at the time, and provided her with the phone and then engaged her in this conversation. Isn't the concern that he took advantage of that vulnerability and that there was some intentional manipulation on that basis?
So I agree with the court that under certain circumstances, it could be a particular vulnerability. I don't agree that in this case that it was. I don't think this situation was substantially different than any other situation where somebody 24 months or older had sex with a teenager in this context. I mean, I imagine that there's always contacts of some degree in there, and it almost appears as though there would have to be some sort of bright line rule providing extra protection to foster care. And I do understand this wasn't a typical foster care situation. This was a locked facility based on the actions of the victim. But again, he wasn't breaking her out of the facility. There were a lot of contacts. Like, objectively, I don't know if it's more than typical, but there were a lot of contacts, but none of them were threatening. And the court mentioned one thing at the sentencing hearing about how Mr. Shaney should have known better and it was his job to stop this relationship before it progressed to the point that it did. That just feels like the type of statement that could be said in every other type of this case. And so at the end of the day, you're charged with parsing the facts to carefully determine whether it was within the court's discretion to sentence an upward departure in this case. But you can almost have paralysis through analysis. Like, if you talk about something long enough, you can convince yourself that any fact supports any conclusion. I've done it. Taking the broad look at this, the question is just, because she was in foster care and there were a lot of texts and phone calls between the two, do you look at that and say, this is exceptional? Like, it's normally inexcusable, but this is above and beyond, and he deserved to have a durational or dispositional departure imposed upon him. That's the question for this court. We're asking the court to find that on the facts proven in this record, and I'm afraid the state may try to raise other facts outside of the ones we've been discussing, and I would just point out, none of that came out in trial. None of that came out at the hearing. No witnesses were allowed to testify or asked to testify. But based on this record, I'm asking the court to find that this upward departure was an abuse of discretion and either resentence Mr. Shaney pursuant to the guidelines or remand for the same from the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We will turn to counsel for the respondent. Please begin when you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is George Kennedy. I'm an assistant Sherburne County attorney, and I appear on behalf of respondent, the state of Minnesota. In this case, the appellant used the victim's status as a runaway from foster care to have sexual intercourse with a 14-year-old. Because of that status, the victim was particularly vulnerable, lacked the typical support for teenagers, and this is not a normal criminal sexual conduct case. That aggravating factor is not part of the underlying offense or some unadjudicated conduct, and that because of that, the reason for departure is legally permissible, the facts and the record support the court's decision, and this court should affirm. I welcome
counsel,
the court's question.
I think you just said this is not the normal criminal sexual conduct case or something to that effect.
Correct, Your Honor.
Is there any evidence in the record as to any evidence of a typical or normal criminal sexual conduct case in the record?
I don't believe there is, Your Honor. Just looking at the elements of the offense, the typical by definition, a third degree criminal sexual conduct for this statute involves a victim that's between 13 and under 16 years old at the time that this offense was committed. I believe the statute's been changed since then. But here we have a runaway from foster care. It isn't just a chance meeting and sexual intercourse happens after that. We have the defendant buying a cell phone for the victim, engaging in daily contact over a fairly extended period of time that then turns into him being a safe point of contact when she decides to run away.
But his contact with her, his behavior, does not make her particularly vulnerable. When you're looking at particular vulnerability of the victim, you're only looking at the victim, right?
That's correct, but you also have to have knowledge, and you have to have some conduct that makes this more serious than the typical offense. And here he has knowledge through that repeated contact, and it's also more serious because he's using that lack of support network that she has in a foster care with a negative relationship, running away, to make it so that he can commit this offense.
But that's not one of the bases for departure. The only basis for departure is her particular vulnerability, right?
Correct.
So that's all we should be talking about today, right?
Particular vulnerability is the fact that has to be found to unlock the court's discretion to depart.
Isn't that a question of law, whether she's particularly vulnerable?
There's a question of law about whether the vulnerability counts under the guidelines, and that's where we can look to cases that say it cannot be part of the charged conduct, it can't be unadjudicated offenses, and it also has to make it so that there is something to take advantage of. If the court looks at State v. Barthman, the victim there was cognitively delayed, and that was the reason that she was particularly vulnerable. There was something about her that made it so that she lacked the typical capabilities of a teenager.
So to be frank, counsel, I'm concerned about the nature of the district court's findings in this particular case of particular vulnerability. So the district court, I think, made two findings, that the victim in this case was particularly vulnerable because she was in foster care and because, to use the district court's term, she was messed up. I'm concerned that a district court could make a finding anytime someone is in foster care or anytime the district court decides that a victim is messed up, that they would be particularly vulnerable. Do you see a problem here?
I understand the court's concern. I don't think that that's a reason to reverse in this case, Your Honor. A single reason to depart is sufficient, and it isn't.
You would agree that not every person who is in foster care is particularly vulnerable, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you would agree that every person who's quote unquote messed up, which might be the universe of people, given the nature of human behavior, that would make them particularly vulnerable.
I agree, Your Honor, but here
the district court has to have some more teeth to its findings to substantiate the conclusion of particular vulnerability. What is it about her foster care situation, or what is it about her messed up situation that makes her particularly vulnerable?
I think that we have those facts in the record here, and I think that they were part of the district court's finding. It's not just that she was in foster care, it's that negative relationship that the defendant knew about with the foster family. It's the fact that she was thinking about running away. It's the fact that she actually did run away from foster care. And once she did that, then he used that opportunity to have sexual intercourse with a 14-year-old. So it isn't just foster care as the sole reason for departure. It's foster care and multiple other things that make her, even for a kid in foster care, particularly vulnerable.
Can you point us to any other case involving a similar departure or a departure based on particular vulnerability with similar facts?
I'm afraid I can't, Your Honor. I can look into that, and if I find something, submit a supplemental source letter after the hearing. But what I can say is that we're looking at particular vulnerability, and it's a fact-specific inquiry into the victim. Just like if you're doing a dispositional departure, a downward dispositional departure, it's a fact-specific inquiry into the defendant and how they are particularly suited to probation or particularly amenable. And here we're looking at a 14-year-old who's in foster care, who's running away from foster care, and doesn't have a support network outside of that foster placement other than a 54-year-old man that she met at a gas station, and she's reaching out to him for shelter, and what she gets instead is she becomes the victim of criminal sexual conduct. So it's a fact-specific inquiry, and I don't think that you're likely to find anything that parallels this. If there are no additional questions, the state would like the court to affirm. Again, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll turn back to counsel for appellant for the final word. There are 5 minutes on the clock.
Once again, may it please the court, Mr. Kennedy. In response to a question asked of respondent, I also looked for case law. I couldn't find anything that dealt with facts that were similar enough to this to warrant being brought up, even unpublished or non-precedential. And I have nothing really further to add in terms of argument as well in this case, other than to just emphasize that I don't think this particular record was sufficient enough to establish a proper basis for an upward departure. There needed to be more, whether that was witness testimony, stipulated affidavits, something. Many of these cases involve a full-fledged trial where we've got a comprehensive record to review, or at the Blakely hearing, there will be numerous witnesses presenting their testimony. We didn't have that here. And based on this record, it's not enough. So again, respectfully request that the court either amend Shaney's sentence accordingly or reverse and remand for resentencing.
Counsel, just to be clear, your argument is that the factual basis for the finding of particular vulnerability was insufficient, not that the district court's findings of particular vulnerability, the statements of finding particular vulnerability was insufficient. If you understand my question, it was inartfully asked.
I think I do, because I've struggled with trying. I keep treating this as a mixed question of law and fact. Like, we're not challenging the fact that the district court found that the victim was in foster care, or that she ran away, or that there were these contacts, the numerous contacts. What we're challenging is the legal determination that rose to the level of being a particularly vulnerable victim.
I understand. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, I have one question as
yes.
well. You would agree, wouldn't you, that as we look at this, we're looking at the facts and findings of particular vulnerability, and we look at them without an eye toward there's a particular type of vulnerability if you're on foster care, if you are a foster care child versus a child who's not placed in foster care. We don't create two separate classes of victims based on, and then decide whether they're particularly vulnerable based on that fact alone.
I know there are, the commission set up certain categories such as age, too old or too young, mental or physical infirmity. There's other statutory categories like somebody under psychiatric care or receiving care and comfort from clergy. I don't believe foster care falls into one of those sort of almost per se categories, if that's the court's question, and if not, I can try harder.
Well, I was just interested because counsel for a respondent had talked about, it almost sounded like a foster care plus. This is foster care plus this individual was in a negative relationship with their placement, plus they had a history of running away. You know, so I was just sort of trying to drill down on the notion that we will look at all of the different facts that the district court relied on to find that an individual was particularly vulnerable without regard to whether that status exists or not. It definitely is a fact, but we don't have a different standard for children who are on foster care versus children who are not.
I would ask that the court not find that. I don't think that would be an appropriate category. I think it would be disrespectful to the foster care system. A lot of children have had a lot of success going through that system, and sometimes it gets a bad rap, which also underscores the fact that this was inappropriate.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Seeing no further questions from the panel, I just want to thank both parties and counsel for your argument and for your briefs that were submitted. We appreciate your time in doing that. And the cases submitted, the court will take this matter under advisement and issue its opinion within the statutory time frame. Thank you.